Welcome back. I think we have one more Uji class after today. Is that right? And then we'll have a week of just being time, sitting in the Zendo for those who'd like to come. Before we go back to Dogen, just this week discovered another, I think, pertinent reference to the time being. Going back a little to our, I think, the first class when we talked about traditional views of time in Buddha Dharma and kind of pre-Dogen views of time in India and so on. And I mentioned that Nagarjuna has a chapter on time in his fundamental verses on the Middle Way. This is another text by Nagarjuna, The Precious Garland, the Ratnavali, not as well known as those Middle Way verses, but he's got this whole section on time, and without spending too much time going into this, I thought it's a nice little refutation of the existence of time in a classic Nagarjunian manner. Well, he has, there's various verses on time just kind of thrown in here, but the key verse seems to me is verse number 69 in the Precious Garland. It says, since a moment ends, it must have a beginning and a middle. This triple nature of a moment means that the world never abides for an instant. So to unpack this verse a little, since a moment ends, any moment ends. Since a moment ends, it must have a beginning and a middle. This triple nature of a moment, meaning beginning, middle, and end, means that the world never abides for an instant. So, like Nagarjuna's verses, often, like when you first hear it, it's like, huh? But I heard somebody give a little commentary on this verse that was, I think it's not that hard to understand. It's just that, like a moment ending is a clear thing that we can see. We might feel as if there are, for example, was that early Buddhist view where there are these kshanas, right? These like 64th of a second or whatever it is, that these actual moments that can't be broken down any further. That's like the building blocks of time. And this is a refutation of that idea, saying that there aren't really these building blocks. And the idea is, like Nagarjuna's reasoning often goes, you just take an obvious thing we can all observe. Here's a moment, and it just ended. You know, we maybe can't catch the beginning of a moment in our experience, but we're experiencing the ending of a moment. Anytime we see something change, that a moment is gone. So we know that moments end. So the logic is that if a moment ends, it must, by definition, have a beginning. Right? You can't have, like, it wouldn't make sense if there was a beginningless moment and then it ended. This is basic common sense. Since a moment ends, we can infer then that it must have a beginning and also then a middle. So, if a moment has a beginning and a middle, therefore, if we're saying that there's these unbreakable segments of time called a kshana or something, that moment, that tiny, tiny bit of time would have a beginning, a middle, and an end. So therefore, it is breakable, right? it can be broken into its parts, beginning, middle, and end. And then you could take, okay, so then we take the middle of a moment, and then the middle of a moment also has a beginning, middle, and end. And that can be broken down and just infinitely, you know, you can't actually, at the end, you can't find some point that has no sections. So if you were to examine that, you're not going to get to the end and say, okay, this middle doesn't have a middle, beginning, and end. It's kind of a funny way of thinking, but this is what Nagarjuna often does. There's a kind of logic here. That because everything has parts, the tiniest moment of time has parts, you can't say there's an unbreakable moment. And then, you know, then it goes so far as to say, it's kind of a leap here in this concise verse. This triple nature of a moment means that the world never abides for an instant. Saying that, like, in this early Buddhist view, the world does abide for just a tiny instant and then it ceases. Mm-hmm. But this is like saying the world doesn't even abide for an instant. There's no such thing as an instant. Mm-hmm. It's completely unfindable. This moment is unfindable. So that's a little like kind of like logical refutation of time. And if it seems strange, this is like the world of Nagarjuna that's very different than we usually think, and difficult to see where he's coming from, but it's logic. It's the same logic, by the way, as you know, being. To say that there's no being. So if we look at the time being, so the time can be can't be found, because there's no beginning, middle, or end of time. Being, or existent, an existent thing, like an atom. And maybe you've heard about this discussion. Again, the early Buddhists thought that there were these unbreakable moments of time that make up the flow of time, and there's these unbreakable atoms that make up the physical world, the material world. And they believed that actually there aren't really like people, for example, they aren't really like human bodies, but there are these little particles, if we're talking about the material world, that make up bodies, and that's like the ultimate truth in this early, called the Vaibhashika school. And Nagarjuna similarly reasons, well, if you take a particle, an atom, and you like blow it up, magnify it, it has like a top and a bottom. Uh-oh, it's not like a partless particle anymore because it has sides. Okay, so let's just take like the very tippy top part of the top of this atom. Okay, well, let's magnify that a little bit more. That little top has like a right and a left. So it has parts, therefore there's no such thing as like a partless particle that can't be broken down any further. So it's the same argument can be applied to material world and to time. And if you're not a big fan of Nagarjuna, we'll leave it at that for today and go back to Dogen, which is much easier, as you know.
I was going to say Jai Einstein.
Yeah. You know, maybe similar in Einstein's world. Time and being are definitely our usual ideas of them are destroyed by the theory of relativity and so on. It's a mysterious realm that these different Buddhists were exploring and scientists explore. And Dogen is exploring, but Dogen, I would say, has a philosophy, but his main point is the liberation in this moment of being time. I would say that's Nagarjuna's point too. I mean, if Buddhism is not about freedom in this time and place, then it's just some useless old artifacts. And you know, we could, it's interesting, you know, because we might feel like, well, why pick up the old useless artifacts, or useful artifacts as they may be, of Dogen? Why not just like directly discuss this presently arising time being? Like, how are we doing? And we could, and we do sometimes. And at the same time being there, I find great joy and challenge in unraveling these ancient teachings of Dogen and the Buddha and seeing how they're actually applying to this. And because, I think, particularly because they're very subtle and challenging, it's nice to talk about them. Otherwise, we might, if we're just discussing how is this presently arising moment, we might stay on a more surface level. But this almost forces us to go into this, to explore the subtleties of the time being in our own experience through, in this case, somebody who is really trying to swim at the bottom of the ocean of being time. Let's see. So we're up to the section of Great Master Hong Dao of Mount Yao, Yaoshan, instructed by Shir To. So now Dogen's, this is on page 3 of this handout. It's, you know, about 3/4 of the way through Uji. If you don't have the text, it's, you can just listen along. So he's going to get into, I think it's the first time in this essay so far that Dogen's going to bring up a Zen story, which almost every Shobo Genzo fascicle has at least one or two. So he's bringing up the stories of the Zen ancestors, and as a little preface to this, Dogen has the very short Shobo Genzo chapter called Buddha Ancestors, or Buddhas and Ancestors, Buso. And this two-page fascicle is just the list of the ancestors of the lineage. It's just the list prefaced by this very short paragraph where Dogen just says, actualizing Buddha ancestors means to uphold them and see them in veneration. So he's talking about this list that goes back to, or that begins with Vipassin Buddha, or Vipassi Butsu, Daiyosho. It's the 7 ancient Buddhas, Buddhas long, long before Shakyamuni Buddha in our eon, through Shakyamuni Buddha, through all the Indian Chinese ancestors up to Dogen's teacher. So it's a list of past, or we might consider past ancient Buddhas, like some of them way, way past, and some of them like alive at the time of Dogen. But Dogen says, actualizing these Buddha ancestors means to uphold them and see them in veneration. It's not limited to Buddhas of the past, present, and future, but it's going beyond Buddhas who are going beyond themselves. You know, you might feel like, well, yeah, it's not limited to these Buddhas of the past and the future, also not limited to the Buddhas of the present. It's kind of like, well, what Buddhas and ancestors are there that aren't in the past, present, and future, you know, or future? But that's what he says. These Buddhas and ancestors are not limited to the past, present, or future. Lest we think that it's a bunch of just ancient dead people. And then he lists these historical ancestors. So, keeping in mind that this story is not limited to the past, and it's not limited to the present, to us talking about it right now, or to future discussions about it. And this was a story that we, some of us, looked into during the last Denko A Sesshin, when we studied some of the ancestors in the Denko Roku, the transmission of light. We talked about this story of Yaoshan. So this might be repetitive to a few. I can't remember who was there. I think some of you were there. But it's a little different now, and it's only a section that's being quoted. Great Master Hung Dao of Yaoshan, instructed by Shi To, Great Master Wu Ji, once went to study with Matsu, Zen Master Daji of Jiangxi. Got it? And let me read you the little part that comes just before what Dogen's going to quote here. He's quoting the second half of this story, which is the 36th ancestor in the so-called lineage. The 36th ancestor, Great Master Hung Dao, visited Shi To, so this is Yaoshan, visiting Shi To and asking him. Here he says, I understand the 12-part teachings of the three vehicles for the most part, but I hear that in the south they directly point to the human mind, see their natures, and become Buddhas. This is still not clear to me. I humbly ask you in your compassion to explain it. And a little interesting twist here is that Dogen quotes it differently here. He says, and he's... Granted, this is the second part of the story, but here it says he repeats the question to Matsu. In this case, Yaoshan says, I'm familiar with the teaching of the three vehicles and 12 divisions of scriptures. So this is this, you know, classic division of Buddhist sutras into these different divisions. So it's like, I'm familiar with all these kind of scholastic teachings of Buddha Dharma in India and so on. But here it says, but what is the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? And so that's the literal translation. So this one, this version says, I'm familiar with these three vehicles, 12 divisions of the teaching, but I hear that in the South, they directly point to the human mind, see their natures, and become Buddhas. So it's really the same thing, but it's a little different way of saying that actually that's that quote of in the south they directly point to the human mind, see nature, become Buddha, is it's attributed to Bodhidharma. So one version says, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West, is the question. The other version of the question is, I hear that Bodhidharma said, or like, I hear the meaning of Bodhidharma is coming from the West, is directly pointing to the human heart, seeing nature, becoming Buddha. But I don't understand. So, you know, why did Bodhidharma come from the West? It's one of those classic Zen questions. But you could interpret this as like, the correct answer, according to Bodhidharma, of why he came from the West was to point directly to the human mind, see nature, see Buddha nature, and become Buddha. So this other version is like, I understand why they say Bodhidharma came from the West, but like, I don't get it. Kind of like that. Anyway, I hear that this is this teaching, this of immediacy, you know, directly pointing to this mind and seeing Buddha nature and becoming Buddha, but it's not clear to me. I humbly ask you in your compassion to explain it. And Yaoshan's teacher, Shi To, says, being just so won't do, and being not just so won't do. Being both just so and not just so won't do. How about you? And Yao Shang was speechless. Remember that story, some of you? And we might also say that this is actually also, you know, indirectly referring to Nagarjuna and his classical logic of the, it's called the tetralemma, you know, the four-part refutation of anything existing. So he often uses this kind of like four-part thing of like, you know, this won't do, not this won't do, both this and not this won't do, and then usually it's at the fourth that's added is neither this nor not this won't do. It's like, you know, all the possibilities for how things can be refuted. So we're left with so that's a Zen teacher kind of using that old Indian way of, but he's kind of doing it in a fresh way by saying this way, or literally emo, again this term that keeps popping up, such, being emo, or, you know, literally like emo won't do and not emo won't do, or like thusness, being just being thus won't do, not being thus won't do, thus and not thus won't do either. How about you? So how could he not be speechless unless he just opened his mouth and let some utterance emerge? There's no way to be, according to Nagarjuna's logic, it's like there's no place to land, there's no place to what's that great quote from the Bible that where Jesus says that something like the fish have their place in the water and the birds have their nests, but the Son of God has no place to rest his head. Mm-hmm. Is that how it goes? You're a Bible
birds
guy.
Birds have their nests, foxes have their lairs, mm-hmm. So the Son of Man has no place to rest his head.
Yeah, so you could say that's kind of like a Madhyamaka quote of Jesus. Could be interpreted that way. There's no place when you're resting as the as God's child. There's no place where we can actually be. So Yao Shang was speechless. Like, what can you say to such a thing? This won't do, that way won't do, this way and that way won't do at all. Nothing will do. And I hear this is like kind of far from the time being, because the time being is like the manifestation of this Dharma position where you can be right here, right now. You can rest your head in the time being.
I got to tell a little story because it's just once it bubbled up. And it's nice because you know, I go back a little ways anyway. So it was after a session in Katagiri Roshi. So it was a question and answer time. And someone, so he's up on the altar there, and someone says, Katagiri Roshi, you know, what would you do if you saw Bodhidharma walking down the road? Mm. And Katagiri kind of looked up, I don't see him. No. No, that was it.
That's a great story. Yep. Does anybody see him? Yeah, Bodhidharma is very hard to see. Sometimes people said that they saw his sandal left on the road. So, anyway, Yao Shang was speechless, so So Shurto said, your conditions for understanding are not here. Or your affinity is not here. You should go to great master Ma, the other contemporary Zen teacher. So he sent him to practice with his friend Matsu. And so Yao Shan went and paid his respects to Matsu and asked the same question. That, you know, I've studied all these teachings, but I hear that in the South they directly point to the human mind and become Buddha. I don't understand. Or in this case, I'm familiar with all these teachings, but what's the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? And Yao Shan says, and this is where now Dogen's quoting now, for the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, do not have him raise his eyebrows and blink. For the time being, to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is right. For the time being, to have him raise his eyebrows and blink is not right. How about you? And with these words, Yao Shan was greatly awakened, and he bowed. And Matsu asked, what truth have you seen that makes you bow? And Yao Shan said, when I was with Shurto, I was like a mosquito biting an iron bull. And Matsu said, since you are like this, you must guard it well. But still, your teacher is Shurto. So that's the extended version, LP, from the Denko Roku. This one, Dogen leaves out the whole first part about this way won't do and that way won't do, and just talks about Yao Shan going to Matsu for the time being. And again, it's this phrase that Uji in Japanese could be just this common expression that means like sometimes. So some of the translations say sometimes I have him raise his eyebrows and blink, sometimes I don't. You know, like in this transmission of life, they don't mention Uji as a concept at all. But Dogen, you know, picks up on the fact that it does say Uji. And comments on the time being section. And, you know, it's quite dynamic here, this part about how it could be translated. So this one by Ka says, for the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and blink, kind of like, almost like you should have him. But some of them say, you know, for the time...
Who's he talking about?
Well, it's not clear. You know, one footnote I thought was quite interesting, because it says, I think this is maybe that Waddell translation footnote says, him, you know, obviously seems to be referring to Bodhidharma here. I'm like, whoa, you know. I would say probably not, really, because the Denko Roku version doesn't even mention Bodhidharma by name. But you could say that, you know. What's the meaning of Bodhidharma coming from the West? Well, for the time being, have Bodhidharma raise his eyebrows and blink. You know, that was that footnote's interpretation. Which is okay, we can interpret however. But this word him, the character for him, can also be like that one or it. Some of the translations have him with a capital H, it with a capital I. You know, so in Zen parlance, it could be like, I could even, at the risk of, you know, trying to define it as some term, what if we just actually say Buddha nature? For the time being, have Buddha nature raise her eyebrows and blink. Can Buddha nature do that? For the time being, don't have Buddha nature raise her eyebrows and blink, and so on. But him, it, I can see what they do here. And, you know, sometimes it's for the time being, I have him raise his eyebrows. And sometimes it's more like, for the time being, have him Yeah, one of them, looks like they did that interpretation. Sometimes I make the Buddha raise his eyebrows and blink his eyes. You know, it definitely doesn't say that literally, but somebody took it that way. For the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and wink. Sometimes I make him lift an eyebrow or wink an eye. At one time present, he was moved to raise his eyebrow and wink. There are times when we make that one's eyebrows rise and his eyes twinkle. That one is capitalized. I think that's maybe the Shasta Abbey version where they really like to almost get a mystical kind of creator into these stories. Sometimes I have him raise the eyebrows and blink the eyes. For the time being, I let him raise his eyebrows and blink his eyes. So, all these different ways, but now Dogen's gonna have a field day with this story. Hearing these words, Yaoshan experienced great enlightenment and said to Matsu, when I was with Shirto, it was like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull. What Daji, or Matsu, said is not the same as other people's words. The eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans. Because, you might wonder why that is. The eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans because mountains and oceans are eyebrows and eyes. That's clear now. The way they are is such as the way they are. The eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans. So sometimes I like to almost visualize what Dogen is actually having, some kind of vision. So right, we have like the eyebrows are like kind of like a little arches, mountain-like arches over these watery eyes. So the it's like the mountains are raising and the ocean is blinking. And you could say we're just talking about these little human features, and it's just poetry. But it's also this expansiveness of little human features becoming like mountains raising and oceans blinking. We could also take this as the just invoking the dependent arising of the whole universe. That's like as someone's, as his, especially we're talking about his, its, hers, Buddha's eyebrows raising and eyes blinking. That's like, you know, at one with the mountains and the waters, volcanically rising and crumbling, and oceans rising and falling, inconceivably interdependent universe. A beautiful image in itself, that the eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans. To have him raise his eyebrows is to see the mountains. To have him blink his eyes is to understand the oceans. I think maybe when we were talking about this story before, it's we could also imagine that this image of the eyebrows raising and the eyes blinking is that one way I sometimes picture this is like young Yaoshan, this monk who is very sincere, trying to get to the bottom of the great matter and not making any progress with Yaoshan being speechless, feeling like a mosquito trying to bite an iron bull, being sent off over mountains and rivers to reach Matsu, finally reaching there, and Matsu was known to be this giant person, actually, and very intimidating kind of character. So I almost picture like little Yaoshan looking up to the great Matsu on his Dharma throne, and saying, "I understand, you know, I've read all these study of these teachings, but like, I this thing about pointing directly to the human mind and becoming Buddha, it's not clear." Kind of like googly-eyed under the great master, and like open and ready also, and like, "Please, I'm ready. I've traveled a long way." And Matsu says, "Sometimes your eyebrows are made to rise and your eyes are made to blink. For example, in this time being, you sitting before me here, someone is making the eyebrows raise and the eyes blink." So like, that's one way of seeing this, is that Yaoshan's mountains and oceans, eyebrows and eyes were activated in the time being of this particular moment. So if that's the case, then having him raise his eyebrows is seeing the mountains, and having him blink is to understand the oceans, like at this open moment of awareness where he was just fresh and present, he saw and understood this interdependently arising universe. He, on some inconceivable way, Yaoshan was just at one with the universe of mountains and oceans. So it's emphasizing here that it's understanding and seeing, all right? Having him raise his eyebrows is to see the mountains, and having him blink is to understand the oceans. The right, so it's Dogen's going through and picking up these words, you know, it's right, the eyebrows blinking is right, and it's sometimes it's not right. So the right answer belongs to him, and he is activated by your having him raise his eyebrows and blink. Not right does not mean not having him raise his eyebrows and blink. Let's read through this part and we can look at it. Not to have him raise his eyebrows and blink does not mean not right. This is a triple negative here. These are all equally the time being. So, and triple negatives, it may be that there's this thing of, you know, this is a kind of follow-up to a kind of sequel, right, to the conversation with Shirto, Yaoshan's conversation with Shirto. This way won't do, not this way won't do, neither this way nor not this way will do, and neither won't do either. So again, this kind of like negating all the possibilities so that we have no place to rest our head. And in this case, there's a kind of positive offering. So we could say something about Yaoshan's affinity was not with this like Madhyamaka negation mode. It's like it didn't work for him to just try to negate everything. And Shirto could see that and said, "Go to Master Matsu, who maybe wasn't so into negation. Maybe he was a little bit more of like a Buddha nature character, you know. His affinity was maybe more with these Buddha nature teachings, which aren't just about negation, right? So for the time being, Buddha nature can raise his eyebrows and blink. That's a lot different from hearing, being this way won't do. And this is how we were talking about this, as I recall, in that session, that, you know, when Yaoshan was first speechless and felt like it was like a mosquito biting an iron bull, he was just like, he couldn't open up to have it just having no place to rest his head. And actually in Keizan's commentary in the Denka Roku, he says, in that commentary on, you know, being like a mosquito biting an iron bull, Keizan, the, you know, commentator says, at that point he was fully complete. Mm-hmm. Biting an iron bull was fully complete, but he couldn't open to it.
Yes. You know, we've had this discussion in Monterey, so...
Yeah, we talked about that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so I'll just say here, don't forget. For me, the turning point, the turning phrase in both visitations is, how about you? What about you?
Mm-hmm.
The second thing that's common to both is the student, earnest as he may be and naive, is still trying to get something out of the teacher,
mm-hmm.
to get an answer. Mm-hmm. Both teachers say... sometimes this, sometimes that, or Suzuki would say, not always so.
Hmm.
And I think what the Zen teachers are pointing to is, are you aware of what you are at this moment? How about you? It's not going to be the affirmation of what just passed or the negation of what just passed. It's going to be what is right here at this moment. I think that's what's being said here, actually. That's the first thing. The second thing is, I wonder if... you know, when in the conventional way we are affirming or denying impermanence, interdependence, no abiding self, if we use other kinds of words than that, which are all bound up in being and time,
uh-huh.
and this whole thing is, all this is about pointing to, in the stories, it seems to me, is pointing to the true reality of impermanence, of no abiding self, of dependent co-arising, and appreciation, full appreciation of that, and not looking for the answer is the answer.
Mm. Yeah, it is about the experience of the moment, and that is how it is. Yeah, well, we could say one thing about the difference between them might be that we could say the first question was, you know, none of these ways you think you are will do. How about you? So kind of like, it is about how about you, but like, there's no way to say, well, I'm, you know, maybe if you were to say, I'm just happy to be alive today. Maybe Shirto would have said, I just said that won't do. You know, kind of like, you know, if you speak, you get 30 strikes of the staff, and if you don't speak, you know. But then when he was with Matsu, you know, you can be this way for this time being, and you can be that way for that time being. How about you? Again, it was like that time he could receive how he was, and we could say really how he was in the first case, he wasn't. You know, nothing exists at all, ultimately. But that's a way we could say, we could answer how we are is like, no way will do. And then when we're asked how we are in another case, we could say, he could say, actually, I just feel happy to be alive today. And Matsu might have said, for the time being, just happy to be alive today. That's okay.
Yeah. And one of those things, I don't think you're saying, maybe you are, that this thing, I'm like a mosquito trying to draw blood out of an iron bowl, is a kind of a admission of his denseness. But actually, I think it is the opposite. I think it's his awareness that I have nothing to extract from a teacher. There is nothing to extract from a teacher. It is stupid to stick my nose in there and try to suck something out of him. That's not the point. So I think it's his moment of enlightenment, and that's why he said he's complete.
Maybe the iron bull is the teacher, but maybe the iron bull is reality.
Well, yeah, of course.
Can't get the proboscis in there. Proboscis in there either.
But the teacher must be the iron bowl for the mosquito. Must be. Otherwise, it's not teaching.
Mm. That could be an interpretation of it. But the great matter is also impenetrable by our ideas. And tiny mosquito proboscis. Is that plural of proboscis? Proboscises.
Snouts.
Snouts. Skeeter snouts. So this section is, maybe we can just hear a couple versions of this triple negative part here. This is the part, the right answer belongs to him. This and that are accustomed to each other. The active is introduced and the passive. Oh, the active is introduced to the passive and is one. Whoa, that's very different. The right answer belongs to him and he is activated by you're having him raise the eyebrows and wink. So that's maybe just a very interpretive one. This and that are accustomed to each other. The active is introduced to the passive and is one. So maybe it's about who's doing the raising of the eyebrows, who's receiving that raising. Being right has become familiar to him, and he has been led by the teaching. Being right means attempting to learn from that one. That one is that which is being invited to teach. Being right has become part of him, and pulls him in. Being right has become part of him and pulls him in. That's kind of a nice short version. It looks like it's these two sides of coming forward, you know, being right, coming forward as right, and actually being given like rightness. It is conditioned by him, he is induced by causation. Correct enters into immediate terms with him, him is ushered in by letting. I think this is a very tricky part here, and I don't even know if we want to get into it more. But there is a footnote on Thomas Cleary's that says, his translation of this section is, it is conditioned by him, he is induced by causation. And his footnote says, the living meaning of Zen, in parentheses, it, which is the word for him or it, as being time is conditioned in its manifestation by the person. The person is manifest according to causation, or karma. This passage, thus, can be taken to mean that though the essence of Zen is in everyone, its expression or realization depends on personal cultivation.
Oneself.
Again, the translation here is, it is conditioned by him, he is induced by causation. So we could say, maybe the relationship between practice and realization is a dependent co-arising. Mm-hmm. Practice and realization are not two, but dependent arising is not a not two kind of relationship.
So when the teachers, both of them say, how about you? They are inviting the teacher to teach.
The teacher as the student.
The teacher says to the student, how about you? Mm-hmm. He's inviting the teacher, mm-hmm. you, to teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to express something. That's yeah. teaching, right? And we're going to get into this later section here about this expression part about words and mind, which is always an important issue for Dogen. So, muddling through this section here, because you can hear that these translations are quite different, and it's what exactly Dogen is saying here is just being played with for the time being here. Not right does not mean not having him raise his eyebrows and blink. Not to have him raise his eyebrows and blink does not mean not right. These are all equally the time being. So after a bunch of negations, one way to hear this is just without trying to figure out exactly how you would trace back a triple negation like this. What does that mean then? It's just like all of these knots where there's no place to rest. All of that actually is the time being right now here. Form and emptiness, not separate. Mountains are time, oceans are time. If they were not time, there would be no mountains or oceans. Do not think that mountains and oceans here and now are not time. If time is annihilated, mountains and oceans are annihilated. As time is not annihilated, mountains and oceans are not annihilated. This being so, the morning star appears, the Tathagata appears, the eye appears, and holding up a flower appears. Each is time. If it were not time, it could not be thus. Now we're back in somewhat more familiar territory as all the way through, that time and being can't be separated. So if we were somehow to annihilate time, how could you have mountains and rivers outside of time? And if you were somehow to annihilate the world of being and existence, how could you have time? They go together like...
But when we assert permanence, and we assert permanent identity, we're separating being and time, in essence.
Permanence and permanent identity?
Yeah. This is a pen. It's always a pen.
Yeah.
Nothing but a pen.
Yeah.
We are separating time and being. Yeah. When we assert permanence, that is something that somehow is above time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And to assert identity, we're separating being from time. The time is always changing. It's always moving. To say this has a substantial existence. As being, so what Dogen does is he keeps being time together all the time.
Yeah, you can't separate.
In conventional sense, we do separate them all the time. We separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But in the sense that we are letting Buddha nature look at us, mm-hmm. we can't separate them.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a... that pen's already long gone.
It is.
And yet then there's a manifestation of something new every moment. And in Buddha Dharma, nothing's annihilated. Things are not annihilated and time is not annihilated. And this is why the teaching, without getting into a loaded topic, there's the teaching of rebirth in Buddhism, because nothing's annihilated. This, at the moment of death, this life is not annihilated. It means like it cut off and there's no further effect. Except, technically, in Buddha Dharma, for an arhat who has extinguished the karmic conditions for another life, which was the goal in early Buddhism, is to not be reborn. And but just a little, you know, again, this is like a sidetrack and big topic, rebirth, but just to mention a little point about this thing about bodhisattvas aren't into this ending rebirth thing. You know, the story, the Mahayana story, is that bodhisattvas, out of compassion for the world, vow to keep coming back and being reborn. But it's different than according to the, you know, classical Mahayana story, it's different than just unawakened sentient beings who are being reborn driven by karma, you know, driven by habitual tendencies, blindly into a new birth as who knows what. But bodhisattvas are like consciously, willingly and knowingly and consciously choosing to be born, often as the story goes, even in particular times and places where they can be of most help. So it's very different. It's in that way, it's not that different from like an arhat who's free to not be fall back into the world of suffering driven by karma. The bodhisattva is also not driven by karmic habit patterns, but they just do this conscious choice that you could say, well, is that, do they come back into the world of suffering then? And that's kind of a hard thing to talk about, because if they're, to be that conscious is, means like, well, we see that suffering is actually an illusory thing. That's why the bodhisattva is happy to go back into this kind of a world. Whereas an arhat, according to the Mahayana, the arhats are kind of afraid of samsara because it's painful, right? It's so messy to live in this kind of place. So this is a little section in the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra that some of you have studied, where the Buddha says the realization of the arhats, the Shravaka path, and the bodhisattvas is identical. They all realize this thoroughly established nature of all phenomena, these three natures and so on. But the difference is that that the Shravakas, this, you know, lesser vehicle path, are just, they're very afraid of samsara, so they don't want to come back. But the bodhisattvas are courageous and also very wise, so they can come back into the illusory world and get into really messy situations, but they have some inkling. They trust that in their next life they will have some inkling that it's kind of illusory. It's not really like as bad as it seems. And that's why they're willing. They're willing to come back. More than willing, they like vow and wish to come back to help the dreamlike beings in the dreamlike samsara become free from the dream.
But it also suggests that compassion annihilates fear.
Compassion annihilates fear. Yeah, I could say that.
Which is why the arhats nice try, nice effort, good result, but you have annihilated fear.
Now, I don't know if we say compassion annihilates fear, or fearlessness gives rise to compassion, or whether we say that they actually just dependently co-arise. There's no chicken and egg thing there. Bodhisattvas realize prajnaparamita and have no fear, and thus at that moment also give rise to great compassion.
I think a bodhisattva has to take compassion as a positive activity, not as an effect.
A bodhisattva in training practices compassion actively.
Yeah, and discovers the annihilation of fear in that process.
Yeah, again, I think we could say it both ways. Some might actually realize prajnaparamita and fearlessness, and they weren't that compassionate, but at the time they realized that, then they see there's no separation at all. I am one with these beings, so how could I not give my life to them? So, I don't know.
I was going to ask, and this may be another class sometime, but when you say a bodhisattva will come back, and we talk about that, a bodhisattva this, a bodhisattva that. Mm-hmm. So, help me, for someone who could say, you know, I'm from Missouri, show me. what are we talking about? Is this an esoteric thing? Is it, you know, is it this moment and then this moment? And it may be, you know, something I need to study more about Buddhist. I don't even know what the term is, but that.
Well, you could say the classical teaching, in a way, is like quite a profound thing for people from Missouri and California. It's such a vow, and it's all built into the story of rebirth too. But you could say the maybe the really simple way to say it outside of even literal rebirth is kind of like the bodhisattva spirit is like, I'm willing to like be here in a moment to moment way. I'm willing to like, in difficult situations, I'm willing to not turn away, for example.
So what's the I? Who's the
eye? This body, mind, moment to moment, time being, experience is which includes an intention, and the intention, the time being time of this intention. It's not even happening to an eye, but there's an intention arising, and the intention is willingness to meet the next difficult moment. You could say that's the principle, and then you could apply it to this whole cosmological thing of rebirth. And you could say that same intention is willing to do that what, according to the early teachings, was like the worst possible thing we could do, is to like be reborn again in such a painful cycle of samsara, and who knows where, like as a hungry ghost or an animal or something. The early story was like this kind of dread of rebirth, and then the Mahayana came into that scene of that dread and said like, wait a second, that looks kind of fearful, and like, I think the interesting thing about this Mahayana movement of great compassion, the Mahayana is like all about the emphasis on infinitely great compassion, united with this infinitely deep wisdom of emptiness, both of which were like kind of, they were both there in the earlier teachings, but those two kind of really like fully blossomed with the Mahayana, and I think they very deeply go together. It's kind of because this world is empty of what we think it is, that's why we're brave enough to come back. If the Shravaka said, well, I know there's not really me, for example. There's just five skandhas, but there really is this horrible suffering world, and like, why would, you know, any kind of skandhas that like come forth from these skandhas in some future life, you know, I'd rather not take it again, go for that ride again. So, but if they see, not only is there not just this, there's not a person here, but even the five skandhas and the whole external world is like an illusory appearance. Then it's like, well, yeah, come back, not come back, it's all the same, actually. And you could say, even though it's all the same, and in this view of emptiness, there could be total equanimity, still it's like, there's this, from that vision is born also, this great compassion to like, it's actually not just neutral. I actually vow to make sure to come back. If I don't vow, I might not come back, because it's like the mind is so equanimous that like it's maybe when it comes time to like choose the next womb, I'm just like, well, this, why bother? And then it might not come back. So I vow to choose a womb and the next time around. And a particular, the most conducive womb to helping the most number of beings. In, you know, and it's not really a womb. That's the thing, the bodhisattva is, I can choose this particular womb because it's not like really the kind of womb I think it is, or that it appears to be. It's an empty womb. Were you born in an empty womb? That to help empty beings become free from empty suffering through the very same way that bodhisattva realized the emptiness of suffering. Something like that.
So bodhisattva can never be self-defensive, self-protective. It's always willing to morph for the situation.
Yeah, I mean, we could say, strictly speaking, maybe that's so, but then we could also say, depends on what we mean by bodhisattva too, right? Strictly speaking, according to the tradition of once, you know, if we're defining bodhisattva as having entered the first bhumi, the first bodhisattva stage or bhumi on the way to Buddhahood, technically, that's the birth of a bodhisattva. And at that point, yeah, it's impossible for any more self-defensiveness. But we also use bodhisattva in this, you know, less strict way to say that, like, basically, like, anyone with the intention to practice this way, and we have these, you know, bodhisattva initiation ceremonies where you receive the precepts and the vows of a bodhisattva, and we say you become a bodhisattva at that point. So, like, maybe the Indian tradition would say, well, really? But this is our great Zen faith and trust that, yes, we vow that we totally were 100% on board with this. We don't even know what it means fully. We can't figure all this out, but, like as Catherine likes to tell that story with Suzuki Roshi saying, just follow the yes. Mm-hmm. The bodhisattva, they just follow the yes. It's like they're, they just want to live in such a way. And then, because of their karmic dispositions, self-defensiveness might arise for such a bodhisattva, even with such a great vow. In fact, it probably does. At least one more time.
And it's seen and it's surrendered.
It's seen and surrendered.
It's seen and surrendered.
Well, and for bodhisattvas with this great wish and vow, even the surrendering of it might not happen immediately. but I really want this to be like this. Mm. You know, like, don't call me that. You know, and but I know, like, I have to surrender this, but I'm not quite willing to yet. But I know, but I vow to. Mm-hmm. And I forget to vow to, and therefore I attack you back. But then later I remember, oh, I vow to, and then I apologize. And so that kind of like just a little messy bodhisattva path, that's the one we know and love. And vow to continue to messily defend ourselves, remember our vow, and let go, and apologize, and continue with the support of all our Bodhisattva friends.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, but there's no alternative. Once we see how it works, we can't really, like, anything else is much harder, actually, right? To ignore it is much harder. Just being so, since you know, time's not annihilated and mountains and oceans are not annihilated, the time being is just arising and ceasing. This being so, the morning star appears. So, you know, these, the references are the Buddha on his night of awakening looked up and saw the morning star. But how nice to, like, think that actually, that, you know, and this is kind of a Zen story. You know, I don't think this is in any of the sutras. I think it's a Zen story that the Buddha, on the eve of his great struggle for enlightenment, at the end of the long night, you know, his understanding was more and more clear, but his kind of trigger, maybe the Zen idea was to make it like a koan, right? Because all the Zen awakening stories are, this is just coming to mind right now, but I kind of think this is kind of a neat possibility. That all the, in Zen, awakening is always in relationship. Very rarely, well, never, does awakening just like happen just from one's own thoughts, just thinking a certain way. In these stories, these ancestor stories, occasionally the awakening doesn't involve another human person at the moment of awakening. And those stories stand out, and actually usually get lumped together, these two particular ancestors. One of them when seeing peach blossoms open, right? And one of them when a pebble hits a bamboo. So through seeing and hearing, those two like are all quoted as a set because they're so unusual. Almost all these other awakening stories happen at the words of some other person. But those two are still, there's a relationship between a peach blossom and the person. And there's a relationship between the pebble sound and the person. So they're not just like somebody sitting there thinking and all of a sudden it's like, we're not thinking and all of a sudden, boom, like their own mind just does something. There's always, isn't that interesting? There's always a relationship. And so it occurs to me that the Zen version of Buddha's enlightenment, because of the sutras, Buddha said, I was contemplating the pinnacle rising and the Four Noble Truths and that was my awakening. So the Zen story said, well, that he was contemplating the pinnacle rising and the Four Noble Truths, but the final little trigger was a relationship to the morning star.
Yeah.
He saw something outside himself. And it's so great that that was the first relationship awakening, and it was like this, you know, what's the morning star is like a planet, right?
Venus.
Tenshin Roshi likes to say, pick up on that point that it's actually Venus of love. It's the love planet, right? Buddha looked up and saw love in between.
How can you get dependent co-arising outside of
relationship? Yeah, exactly. Dependent co-arising is relationship.
You can get impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Come and go. Mm-hmm. You can't get dependent co-arising outside of relationship.
Dependent co-arising is relationship, but you could say the Buddha was contemplating relationships in his own mind, awakening. But the Zen stories always say it's not just about contemplating relationships, it actually is enacting a relationship.
Yeah.
So that's the morning star. And in this case, the morning star is... being time, right? Along with mountains and oceans, that actually, that Venus happened to be like rising according to its Dharma position, you know, at that particular time, and the Buddha sitting under that particular tree in that particular town of Gaya in Magadha, and like, raised his eyebrows and blinked at that morning star. That and coughed, And that time being was like the
consummation.
The consummation. Again, I was going to say, you know, the Dharma wheel started turning, but again, as I mentioned before, technically the setting in motion the wheel of Dharma happened with a human relationship. The first human that understood Buddha's teaching. So that's when actually the wheel of Dharma started turning. And Ajñāta Kaundinya heard that the first sutra of the Four Noble Truths and said, I see. And the Buddha said, Ajñāta Kaundinya sees. And then we have the morning star appeared. So then the Tathagata appeared due to the morning star. And then an eye of Mahakashapa appears. And then the Buddha picks up a time being flower. And Mahakashapa's eye sees this flower. And that's the second awakening in the Zen story. First is Buddha sees the morning star, and the next one is many years later, Mahakashapa sees this flower. So there was, and now it's being held by the Buddha, so we have a transmission between two humans. And from then on, pretty much, I think, in this book, I think after those first two, it's almost all dialogue, conversations where they wake up. Each is time. If it were not time, it could not be thus. Any further words? Questions? From the assembly? Yes. Okay.
I'm just trying to sign my little thing for myself. I just want to make sure that I can. Okay. So, in this story, okay, Yao Shan asked the teacher for help, for some degree of enlightenment, right? The teacher was not able to give answers.
The first part, yeah.
Okay, so the student has to look inside himself. It's like this. I think of the term what the student can. What the student has to do is really look inside himself to see the interdependence of all things as well as the impermanence of all things. And that's where time comes into being, and there's time comes into play, right? And so, once the student realizes this, he's like, no, I could never have extracted this from anyone else. This understanding had to come from me, right? And then, he's able to move forward by seeing that, oh, so for the time being, things are as they are, and whatever arrives in front of me in my life, and I'm in a relationship with them.
Yeah,
and for... part of, and it's a part of me, and it's inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
But he had to get to this point himself.
Yeah, and it was about this point. It was about this time being, you know, his eyebrows raising and blinking in a particular time being that is this one. So,
But see, that's the part that really gets me, like this whole eyebrow thing. And I sort of... like when Jiami described it as kind of a metaphor for the student-teacher relationship, that kind of made sense to me. And so I can't seem to understand what's beyond that right now. I don't know.
Beyond?
Stuff. Yeah, like, I know we've just talked about this for an hour, but I'm still kind of confused. I mean, to me, it's...
Are you like a mosquito biting an iron bowl?
Well, so the master raises his eyebrows and does this and doesn't do that. And so the student is just like, okay, now what? So I better figure this out for myself. Right? And then the mountain stuff is just another metaphor. But it's all pointing to the self.
It's all pointing to the experience of each person's time being present here now experience. So yeah, you might, you know, to think that you want to, you know, get a logical explanation of each sentence, maybe in this kind of Zen presentation and Dogen's kind of thing, it's maybe not even so much about that. It's not so much that we have to like get to the bottom of each of his sentences, because he's playing. It's poetic play. And the point seems to be that he keeps coming back to is it's just this experience of this time being, and that it's okay. It can be right, and it can be not right, but that's okay too. But each moment is an expression, and everything is included. Everything's included. Yeah, everything's interdependent and included. Whereas the first part of the story was kind of like nothing's included, right? Like, this won't do, and that won't do. Actually, nothing will do, which is another side, you know, another legitimate Dharma teaching. But the part where that really worked for him was to hear about the interdependent inclusion of everything. And this particular moment of time being, you know, it's always, so all of this, as we're discussing this and thinking about ancient stories, it's really always about here, right now.
The last paragraph of the Metta Sutta kind of says that, which says, standing or walking, sitting or lying down, during all one's waking hours, let one practice the way with gratitude, not holding to fixed ideas, eyebrows up, eyebrows down, not right, not yet, endowed insight, free from sense appetites. One who achieves the way will be free from duality and birth and death. I think it's pointing to that.
Yeah, standing or walking, sitting or lying down is like the time being.
Yeah, it's like, when I was sitting down, I got enlightened, so I think I'll always kind of know you can walk too. Sometimes walking, sometimes sitting.
Yeah, it's where, you know, it's the kind of thing that, like, these stories are, and this is all, you know, everything I'm saying is I don't mean to be like giving the definitive explanation of this story either, because I think they're very difficult and strange stories. So I just offer this as some ideas to think about for the time being. Yes, Rich.
Well, one might ask, at what moment is confusion arising for you?
Actually, I think I'm getting it.
Well, at what moment do you think you're getting it?
I'm going to try to answer this. It's a little more clear. Look at the story. I'm sorry. I just want to say that I'm getting this idea of not holding fixed views.
Yeah.
I think it kind of follows that. It's about the relationship and not holding to linking.
Yeah. And the relationship is inconceivable, actually, right? It's like we can't actually find a relationship it's an inconceivable thing. That's just a relationship. Actually, is a time being experience, right? It's not like a relationship is some fixed thing. It's just the interconnection between people and things and experiences in each time and place being. So
temporary,
impermanent. Yeah, it's like a relationship. It's just a momentary thing. It's not like, oh, I had this particular relationship for like 2.5 years. It's kind of like we can't say things like that, really, right? According to the time being.
Relationships change.
All we can say is like, I had this relationship for one Dharma position moment of time being, and that's all. Or we can't even maybe really say I had it, but just see right now there's a particular manifestation of this relationship that we all have. If you really, I think too, as we're about to end this overtime being class, there's like this particular relationship we're all sharing right now for this one moment, never, ever again. Sometimes when I open to that, it's like, it's so poignant, you know? It's like, and what is it? We don't even, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it. And you know, saying like, I almost get it. What this is right here. And yet, like, it's gone. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.